Jim Gallison. I am a tech writer for a Silicon Valley company, and I have a kind of hobbyist interest in observing political systems and propaganda and anti-science.
This is a continuing episode of a series about fascism and science fiction. Cool. So we've gotten through a curated selection of contemporary. Now we're going to move into speculative, it looks like.
Yeah, this is the realm where you imagine science fiction should really shine, right? This is where authors are imagining, well, we know what fascism looked like, and we have an idea of what it looks like today, but what forms might it take in the future, right? What might be the sort of driving ideology that makes a society fascist in the future? And so people have speculated on a lot of interesting dimensions. So you mentioned we earlier, and that was one of the points about that was psychosocial surgery, which has been a big deal off and on. It appeared in, you'd see it in the 60s, like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest has a really grim ending where Jack Nicholson's character, I probably shouldn't give spoilers, but it's a very old film. So yeah, he eventually experiences a lobotomy, which puts an end to all of his antics.
It's a great movie, so you should go watch it.
It is.
Yeah.
Yes, and still relevant today, I think.
It's the movie where the term Nurse Ratched comes from. So if you've never, don't know where that came from, this is the movie.
This is the movie, yes. She is, man, what a character she is. And so we imagines a future, though, where psychosocial surgery has evolved to the point where they can remove very specific aspects of personality. And what the regime is interested in removing is imagination. And so they have identified the part of the brain that is responsible for imagination, and then people are forced to go in and get that removed. So it's a really funny, fun book until the end. The end is extremely grim. And then you have Aldous Huxley with Brave New World, of course, and he imagines this world of industrialized eugenics, where there are factories that create humans according to spec, and humans, there are like, I don't know what it is, five classes of humans, from alphas to, you know, gammas,
right?
And they're all given particular functions in society. And then, you know, they're controlled by drugs, and they have subliminal indoctrination and sleep teaching, and so all of these high-tech ideas are brought to bear to control people in the future society.
This is where the tech bros would really, you know, be like part of the picture here.
Well, you know, of all of the dystopias that science fiction has come up with, it's one of the most pleasant in that, you know, there's really not any brutality, you know, and it's there's not any rule through terror. It's just everything is so engineered that people aren't capable of even conceiving of another sort of, you know, a better way of being, right? And then you have, of course, Orwell. You know, a few years later, Orwell wrote 1984. That's, in some ways, it's a parody of party discipline, but it imagines a future of ubiquitous surveillance and total control of language. So people are, and Echo talks about that in his essay a little bit, about how he had learned words after the liberation of Italy that he just didn't know. Words like democracy and freedom and those sorts of things that had just, as a child, he had just not been exposed to. So Orwell, you know, imagines that, takes that to its extreme limit with Newspeak, you know, which is this engineered language that's completely devoid of any concepts that can allow you to even conceive of anything revolutionary or out of line with what the party wants you to think. You had 1967, you had Patrick McGoohan's TV series, The Prisoner, which has a very devoted cult following. And it imagines a near future, I mean, actually the present, but a very near future where mystery authorities that might be the government or might not be have access to various mind control technologies and are deploying them and experimenting with them on this captive population. And the guy in charge of the village is named Number Two. And in the first episode, he imagines that this village, as they call it, the village, is the model for the world. And that his hope is that these mind control technologies will be deployed into the population at scale. And then everything will be great. And of course, Patrick McGoohan plays a character who does not adhere to that view and instead wants to destroy that society.
Right, right. Yeah, I caught that on a lark one time. I didn't really know what I was watching, and it was just really enjoyable. I was just the acting strong. It's the style of movie that does a lot of that paints within its capability to tell a science fiction story with their low tech strategies. It works really well. It was it's classic.
Yes, and very well written. And you know, the themes resonate today. It's, you know, just as important today as it was in 1967.
I snuck in Snowpiercer, and I thought I don't know where it belongs in this three categories. I felt like it must be speculative because it's about a future situation. So Snowpiercer is really cool because it's a story of people trying to survive with few resources, and so they can no longer be as extravagant as they used to. And now the people in the train, and by the way, I'm talking about the TV series, the movies. The same story, but compressed. And the TV series, I think, runs about four seasons. And I actually like the TV series better because they have a lot more time to talk a lot about more story. And so what happens is there's an organization imposed upon them where the people in first class get more resources and more comfortable cabins, da 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 da. And then the person in second class. And then there's the people who like snuck on the train before they left gym. For some reason, a bunch of people weren't just going to lay around and get frozen because the world was freezing. They wanted to get on the super train, and they forced themselves on. Well, those people ended up in what they call the tail section of the train. And they have like the worst conditions where they're all like packed together in like these cattle car type conditions, and they get the least resources.
Well, clearly they should have built a wall to prevent that from happening.
Oh, I think they did have some walls, but well, chain link fences, but there, you know, when enough people get upset, walls will come down. So when an entire city wants to get on your train, it's difficult to keep them out. I mean, they did shoot up a lot of people, but it didn't matter. So anyways, it's basically a political science story at that point, or science fiction story of this train that travels around and has to move continuously for some artifice reason. Got like I think of it as John Galt's motor of perpetual energy, because if the train's operating, they generate enough power to keep the train running. But if the train stops, you know, everything shuts down on the train. And there's a reason that they can stop for short amounts of time, but they generally try to keep moving all the time. And they have tracks built all around the world because this is kind of somewhat planned ahead because of this disaster that the world was freezing was coming. So yeah, it's a story about how these factions get along or don't get along. How oppressive it is. What happens if, you know, how does crime and punishment work? Well, you go to the drawers. They basically like put you in a drawer and suspended animation. And, you know, if they need some parts or something, or if they need to turn you into nutrients, you know, any of those things could happen. Or if they want to bring you back because they haven't damaged you in the drawer, they could take you out. So it could be, you could just be in the drawers for like say 3 years, or you could be in the drawers forever, or whatever.
That's a little bit like Logan's Run, where when you turned, I don't know, 28 or 35, whatever the year was, when you were on Last Day, they would stick you in the novel, they stick you in a drawer and freeze you. In the movie, there's this big ceremony where you sort of dance around and then get blown up, which is unintentionally hilarious, I thought. But
now, what happens in this story, in this series, is a little bit like what we're talking about, is where there's one faction that's in control, of all aspects, you know, totalitarian aspects. But then the other faction eventually does get the upper hand, and then it starts devolving into totalitarianism, and then they start having this conversation about, well, should we be as bad as those other guys, you know? Because, you know, yeah, they were bad, but And so that kind of conversation starts happening. They get a little bit better. And then, you know, there's another circumstance that happens later that kind of destabilizes things. But it's a cool show because there's not a lot of resources. It's like what would happen if you're on a spacecraft, basically. And if you can't get along, you can really screw up everybody. the race will be gone.
It's not at all like the human situation on the planet, this one planet.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's cool. I'll have to check that out. I had a couple of other movies on the list. Of course, there's Kubrick's Clockwork Orange, which again is concerned about mind control technology. And then, the other big category, it could be a category in itself, is computer-controlled societies. Mm-hmm. So who knows how many stories and movies have been made on the concept of, well, humans surrender all of their agency to some supercomputer that runs everything. And you could just like go down the list. Frederick Pohl wrote the Star Child trilogy in 1963. He had a computer called The Plan of Man. And much like 1984, you'd be required, whenever you like entered a room, you had to go over to the computer terminal and enter a status report that you had arrived. So it didn't really have ubiquitous surveillance in that sense. A Prisoner had an episode with a computer called The General. Star Trek, of course, had multiple computer-controlled societies that Kirk has to go in and basically give it a logic problem that it can't solve to cripple it, which, you know, always works. Always works, giving the computer a problem that it can't solve, and that's like, okay, we're done here. There was the famous 1970 movie, The Colossus, The Forbin Project, one of the best, where the Americans create Colossus to control the nuclear weapons, and the Soviets create Guardian to control their nuclear weapons. And then as soon as they power them on, they immediately start talking to each other, which is bad. And of course, the two supercomputers immediately realize that, you know, the humans are the threat. Mm. And so they just take over, and Colossus announces to everyone it is now the voice of world control. And then they launch Colossus launches a nuke, and Guardian launches a nuke just to demonstrate that they're, serious. And that doesn't end well, of course. And you can go on and on with computer-controlled societies. And so I would think one of the strongest lessons from science fiction about fascism is never turn your society over to computers. So we can have a whole conversation about what's happening right now and how humans have completely ignored that lesson.
I'm not really sure what you're referring to, Jim. I can imagine what you're referring to, but I don't know if it's the same thing.
So are you wanting, leading me into that discussion?
I'm trying to decide.
Do you want to talk about other stuff before we get there?
Can we just do a quick sidebar into it maybe? So,
well, sure. As you know, there's been a lot of discussion about efficiency.
Right, right.
And, of course, how computers must be more efficient than humans. And so we really need to turn over large swaths of the function of our government to AIs, right? Because they're just going to do the job better and faster and more efficiently and whatever. Now, I don't know if these people who make this argument have used any of the current AI technology. I've used quite a lot of it for quite a number of things. And I can tell you that I would never want to substitute the judgment of a human being for any one of these large language models that we call AIs. It would be instantaneous disaster.
And, come on, not instantaneous. Instantaneous? Well, I
mean, depending on what you hook them up
yes,
to.
Yes, there we are. Yeah, yeah.
I've had these AIs write code for me, and sometimes it's like, oh, that's pretty close, but it's still dead wrong.
Right.
To, I don't even know what you're thinking. I don't even know why you believe this code would work, because it does not work.
Yeah.
So when we talk about artificial intelligence, there's literally zero intelligence behind it, right? If there were a little bit of intelligence, maybe. But no, there's literally zero intelligence. It's just a giant billion-dimensional statistical fit.
Well, you know, and this is they'll get better. But the point of the lessons of science fiction is, you know, it's not a great idea. Okay, because those
computers are better, which it will.
Yeah,
it's still a bad idea. And the more capable the computers are, the worse the outcome, right? Because there's the AI alignment problem, right? It's like you give an AI a problem to solve, and unless its thinking, quote-unquote, is aligned with general human goals, it could do something just crazy to solve the problem, you know? The classic, like, well, we need you to make a bunch of paper clips, and then the AI decides, oh, well, okay, I'm going to go make a bunch of paper clips, and then it just starts tearing down human structures, you know, buildings or whatever, to get at the steel.
Ooh, yeah, that's when you combine AI to nanotechnology, so they can, like, restructure the physical universe at will.
Yeah, that's going to be fun when we manage to do that.
Well, yeah, which is why... In Stellaris, which is I added to the speculation list here as well. And by the way, this list we're going to put in the show notes so you can check it all out at your leisure, and you can click on the links and go visit some of these books and movies, and in this case, a game. So Stellaris is a game of, think of it like kind of like Civilization mashed with a war type game. And what it is, it's a grand strategy game. And of course, Jim, of course, if you research AI technology, it's labeled as dangerous technology. It is, they tell you right that this is dangerous technology.
It comes with a warning.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, because your goal is to like create your solar system to become, you know, a larger and larger empire among, and then eventually you meet other solar systems that are doing the same thing. And so, you know, sometimes people don't agree with each other, and wars break out. And it's a beautiful game because it incorporates models like what we're talking about today, Jim, about fascism, militarism, democracy, theocracy. There's all these different kinds of government structures that you can have for your civilization, and you will encounter several other types of government structures too, and or corporatocracy. Well, they start getting really crazy later because this game's been around a long time. They got to keep something fresh, so they have necromancy, and then of course there's the age of the machines. There's hive mind civilizations. And anyways, this game applies a lot of the things that we'll be talking about fascism, and the features of fascism are also somehow, I'm not going to say they're all represented in the game, but the game represents a lot of body of political science. And so it's pretty cool. If you're interested in that kind of political science, space warfare, it's like Sim Earth, except now this is intergalactic, or it's a galaxy-wide type situation. It's a fun game. It's a very addictive game. You could spend like literally... I don't know what I'm up to. My son was teasing me one day, but I believe I have multiple weeks of my life spent in the game, not in a row, of course, because I have like a day, you know, day job and all this other kind of stuff. But over the years I've had the game, I never tried it. You don't play just 1 hour games. I've got 4 hours. Okay. I can start something.
I played it a little bit. It's a beautiful game, but I also could see that, oh, this is a huge time commitment. I cannot get sucked into this. So I was able to walk away from the black hole of Stellaris.
Right, right. It is a black hole. So this game comes with a warning label as well. It's highly entertaining, but if you like numbers and models, it will pull you in because you're going to have to run economies and it'll keep you pretty busy.
It seems more fun than Eve Online, which is basically spreadsheets, right? I've heard people say it is like having a second job because you end up doing like, you go down to the loading dock and you spend 8 hours just like loading boxes and whatever, and then you have to go, you have a spreadsheet that you have to manage. I never played it. I've just heard people describe it that way.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, cool. But yeah, so that game knows that AI is dangerous technology, and so we should take note. Growing up has never been easy, even in prehistoric Mesopotamia. Young Akia was the runt of a tribe that's legendary for feats of strength. But Akia prefers feats of intelligence. However, that gets him no respect from his peers. He gets into more trouble when he accidentally disrupts his tribe's corner on the market of hauling goods due to his invention of using levers. this idea becomes so popular that the neighboring tribes no longer require his own tribe's services. To make matters even worse, music television marketers from the future are meddling with the culture of the region. At first, Akiya is excited by the strangers, but then realizes that there is a danger in becoming dependent on their gifts. But the stranger's pull is drawing the youth away from all of the tribes. So Akiya must find a way to save his people, join the music television marketers with their technological magic, or join with his elders who had rejected him. Caveman Funk, a novelette by Lancer Kind, is available on Amazon Kindle. Check out the show notes because we have got an amazing plethora of information that you will be interested in. We have visualizations of fascism over time. We have tables of how science fiction rates at different levels of fascism. And we have, of course, our very own United States of America rated there with a graph on the increasing levels of fascism. The series started at episode 337. If you missed that first episode, like my friend Kevin, you can find all of the episodes by going back to scifithoughts.space and you can type in the episode number of what you're missing, and the search engine will find it for you. Next episode, more Jim Gallison. How about we talk about how to like test or recognize fascism? You know, we kind of opened a little bit about that with Echo and Brit.
Yeah, that's the real trick, isn't it? To quote Han Solo, describing and identifying fascism, right? And what makes it distinct from ordinary authoritarianism or totalitarianism? Why isn't it just a synonym for an extremely rigid society based on total power in the hands of one or a few people? You know, so what makes it distinct?